go ahead, finish on the Donaldson case, and then Representative Dix wants to ask you a question.
Oh, okay, sure. On the Donaldson case, 1975, Bill Taylor, they asked for the citation on that. It's 422 U.S. 563. Essentially established that you have to be a danger to self or others. And that was the constitutional decision on that. And that specifically is a problem with the commitment expansion. But the outpatient commitment is a whole other ball of wax, and I can go into that in a second if I'll answer that question.
I was just going to suggest, Mr. Chair, that we maybe she can prepare testimony, and I'd certainly be willing to read it rather than ever fly her testimony.
Yeah, right. So, I'll tell her that. That's right.
Definitely an excellent suggestion.
I just had downstairs send it to her. Well, she's pretty upset about it. She's worked a number of years in MHLP, and she's seeing AMI pass this throughout the U.S. So far, she's studied North Carolina, Georgia, Hawaii, Tennessee, and Vermont, and she's found severe problems with all of them. North Carolina did vote in extra money for their version of the outpatient commitment, and she said however much money they put in is not enough to cover the problems. By the way, she said that an example of some of the problems that they've seen in other states is the recidivism rate is the same through the outpatient system. So someone said, well, we'll save money with this kind of bill by being able to reach people sooner. And what they're seeing is the same kind of problems and what she called serious constitutional law problems. Basically, she sees this as what she called an end run around the right to refuse drugging issue, which I've worked on in Massachusetts and in other places. There's been a number of decisions on the right to refuse psychiatric drugs and shock treatment. And frankly, I think that they're wonderful decisions, but there's one pending right here in the state of Oregon. There's a four-year lawsuit happening with Oregon State Hospital, and there's a couple of attorneys here in Salem working on it. It's coming to a head right now. One of the clients had several hundred forcible electroshock treatments at Oregon State Hospital. Several hundred forcible. No law has changed. No regulation has changed since then. So we're talking about really basic civil rights violations going on in there. I'd like to mention that from what I understand is that AMI has really provided a lot of support from this, but the viewpoint is not shared by all parents. There are a number of parents, and we'll be having them write to you, who do support civil rights for the members of their family. The public also is not necessarily represented by AMI. I've talked to quite a number of people that have had parents and relatives hurt within the mental health system, forcible shock treatment, forcible drugging, and so forth, who the public is very concerned about it. And I feel that
David, to your direct knowledge, either in that case or in your direct observation, what year was the last time shock treatment has been used in the institutions in this state?
Well, down in Eugene, Sacred Heart does do shock treatment. They have limited the amount of shock treatment due to the lawsuit, but there hasn't been any kind of law written into the books to protect people on shock treatment. And frankly, if we all agree that forcible shock treatment is wrong, why don't we run a bill through the legislature and get that on the books so that people are protected?
Representative Dix.
I guess to follow up on the chair's question, the state hospitals, when was the last time it was used, to your mind, aside from Sacred?
You mean forcible shock treatment?
Right.
According to the attorneys, they've cut down on shock treatment considerably. So as far as I know, none. And that would be good to follow that de facto situation up with the law. Why not? Everyone seems to agree upon it. It would be real helpful. But forcible drugging is routine. And does continue. We've had a member who is basically in a similar situation as this bill, which is called the trial visit. And as far as we've seen, that bill has resulted in coercive drugging out in the community. I'd like to mention, in terms of drugging, people see, oh, well, shock treatment. I could understand being dragged down the hall, given electrodes in the brain. That's terrible. One flew over the cuckoo's nest and so forth. But the drugs do have severe problems also. Is everyone familiar with tardive dyskinesia? Are you familiar with tardive dyskinesia? Okay, that's, I'm sure a number of people in the room are. Tardive dyskinesia is one of the results that happens to a number of people from the major psychiatric drug. It's the neuroleptics. Well, basically, the major family of drugs in the psychiatric system has been the neuroleptics, also known as the major tranquilizers or antipsychotics, ever since the 1950s. The brand names include Thorazine, Stelazine, Meloril, Haldol, Prolixin, Navane. All of those drugs now list a number of effects. One of those is tardive dyskinesia. Approximately 15% of users, according to studies, get that, though it varies, each study varies. But the fact is that some people get it. Basically, it's twitching. For some people, the twitching does go away. But for a lot of people, even after the drug is stopped, in fact, the drug can mask the symptoms, so it sometimes only stops after the drug is stopped. Starts after the drug is stopped. It's twitching of the mouth, tongue, face, hands, and arms area. And it's a symptom of brain damage. Now, some people, eventually, it goes away after a few years. But there are a number of people who, for whom it's permanent. Dr. Peter Breggin has also written a book about the neuroleptics, saying that basically tardive dyskinesia is the brain damage that can't be denied, that there's a whole range of other problems with the neuroleptics, such as memory problems, learning disabilities, and other kinds of brain damage. Now, I'm not here just to say, well, ban Thorazine totally. There are a number of people in our grassroots group that take Thorazine, but what we really beg happens is alternatives to drugging, to please be made available. Now, right now, a lot of the parents and us are in the same boat. They say, well, people need help. But I think the problem is we have a bigger horizon about what we feel is help. We feel that counseling, talk therapy, housing for the homeless is an obvious alternative. Quite a whole range of alternatives have been explored. And we feel that these alternatives should be made available. I should mention also, as far as the neuroleptics, I recommend that everyone read the November Journal of the American Journal of Psychiatry. And that's the American Psychiatric Association's official magazine. That issue has a number of articles in favoring outpatient commitment and talking about the problems that they've had with it. But part of that issue also talks about neuroleptic malignant syndrome. And ever since the 1950s, people have known that a number of people do die and that it is associated with the use of the neuroleptics, which are very powerful drugs. This article actually did a study and found that there's quite a few number of people dying from neuroleptic malignant syndrome. So basically, when you combine a coercive treatment with a drug that can possibly kill or maim, that's quite a combination. A lot of people have talked about the biochemical model. Well, down in Eugene, we had some testimony, and we talked about what to do about unemployed people. Someone gets unemployed and feels sad. Well, the biochemical model says, well, drug them. If they're feeling depressed from being unemployed, drug them. Well, that's not good enough. That's basically what this lawsuit is all about, and the provisions in here don't protect civil rights at all. Right now, the attorneys who are suing the state have found that psychiatrists generally rubber stamp anything that comes their way in terms of forcible drugging. They found that 99% of cases are routinely approved for forcible drugging. So basically, that's not, you know, it's kind of throwing out basically the U.S. system of civil rights, saying guilty to proven innocent, it's a government by law, not by subjective judgment of some doctors. I find it kind of throwing out the baby in the bathwater as far as basic human rights protections. And I would say that what's really needed on an emergency basis is some kind of hearing about what kind of alternatives are available for people other than a pill. One example from that in terms of brass tacks is what kind of liability will the state have when they start ordering more and more forcible drugging? the tardive dyskinesia cases have been enormous in the settlements that have been happening recently. But frankly, I think that this is on a moral level in terms of values, that you've heard a lot from the parents and the doctors, but I feel that you should hear from people who have been through the system. I went through this mental health system about 10 years ago while I was going to school at Harvard. I had emotional problems and I was put into a very good psychiatric institution. There I experienced forcible drugging. I experienced Thorazine, Stelazine, Haldol, and the drugs are extremely powerful, dangerous, and the people who experience the coercive procedures are definitely hurt inside. I mean, it's basically a human rights violation, and that's what the country's all about, is saying that human rights violations are bad, and it does definitely hurt. I think what the key here is that what happens is when someone goes through the system, society stigmatizes them. So you're not going to be hearing from a lot of the people that have been through the system coming here and talking to you. I've worked in it long enough, I feel comfortable with talking about it, but approximately 15% of society each year is diagnosed as mentally disordered, and that you just don't hear from them. So the perspective of a parent is different from a patient. The parent says, what am I going to do about Susie Jane? But the Susie Jane might be in the hospital saying, my God, I'm being dragged down the hall to a forcible injection. I know that that injection hurts, that it hurts my mind and my thoughts, and I don't want it. See, a lot of people feel, oh, well, if they deny the drugging, then that's a symptom of the illness. Well, I've just talked to the attorneys who are working on the lawsuit with Oregon State Hospital, and that's one of the main criteria that'll probably change, which is that you cannot use the denial of the drug as a sign that the person is ill. It's sort of that catch-22. So people have very, very rational reasons for staying away from the system. I think we should try to please the customer and come up with some alternatives that people will seek out from the streets. Instead of, I mean, if you talk to someone on the streets about the mental health system, they say, my God, I was held down, I was drugged, I have tardive dyskinesia, I've seen shock treatment. I mean, you hear horror stories. Well, let's go out and please the customer. Let's come up with alternatives that people will seek out. And I can get you a lot of folks here to come here and say that they beg for some kind of emotional support system that is non-coercive. I think that's the key. I think people will seek help if their rights are absolutely guaranteed. Basically, I'm calling for kind of a healthy dose of democracy in the mental health system. I've seen over and over that when groups of people get together, they can often solve their own problems. The answer is not to just go for force and for drugs, because these are citizens too. People say, well, what about society? Well, these folks are citizens, are voting citizens, guaranteed with the same human rights as everybody else. I don't think that the answer is simply to give them a drug. Frankly, even if the drug didn't cause the possibility of tardive dyskinesia or death, I still think that coercion is the wrong approach. But the fact is that they do. I recommend that everybody who would like look up in the physician's desk reference for any of the major psychiatric drugs, and they all mention the possibility of death from the drugs. These are extremely powerful drugs that can cause a lot of problems. So in summary, I say hold back, look at this. There are going to be a lot of people who want to have some kind of input on this. Some of the organized folks, like AMI, have been on top of this bill and helped write it. But I think we should give more weight to the ACLU than just one vote on that committee. The ACLU knows about basic constitutional law, and that, you know, is the important thing. The majority of society cannot oppress a minority. The minority has fundamental human rights that just voting it out of existence won't work. The minority's rights must be protected, must be heard, and I would ask you to please slow down and do this carefully. Not just grease this thing right through, but to really look at the civil rights violations and to give folks a chance to come here and express this these concerns. Are there any questions?
Representative Dix.
Two things. One, she, the reference to she throughout your testimony, that person's name again?
Yeah, I mentioned that. It's Susan Steffen, who's the staff attorney for the Mental Health Law Project. I have a phone number if you'd care for that now or later.
I can get it later.
Okay.
But you will ask her to provide testimony?
Yeah, I'll ask her to write. She's pretty upset about it. She was outraged is what she was. I think you might have been hearing a lot from the parents and the professionals, but there's a hell of a lot of other people that should be heard in this case.
And the second group of people were parents who or relatives
right.
who don't like the bill, and I would really wish that maybe you could solicit testimony from those people as well to be heard for the record.
One of the cases is happening right now. Bennett Rauch has a daughter who is a student at OSU at U of O, who went to New York on a trip and was committed to an institution there and is receiving forcible drugging every single day. Her speech is slurred. She's having a lot of physical problems, and she's afraid to bring her back to OSH because the same things happen there. The same forcible injections, the same total reliance on pushing pills, basically. So, I'll have to write soon. There's some very concerned people about this, and actually it's kind of fun to point the bill out to people because they say, hey, bad grooming is going to be in Oregon in ORS. You know, it's almost like almost a joke. It's under the case management provision down here.
Thank you.
Sure.
Further questions? Representative Bellamy. Dave.
Oh, I'm sorry.
One more question.
Oh, sure. I'm concerned in one of your letters when you make the statement that this bill does not have grassroots support. And then you go on to state that the Alliance for the Mentally Ill, a main supporter, does not have community support. Those are very broad statements for an individual to make when he's providing testimony here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll give you an example. I've spoken to AMI meetings. I've talked to quite a number of AMI people. And I do feel that they do represent a problem that I feel that we all share, which is the need for some kind of help for a large number of people. But where we differ is that I've talked to quite a number of parents and individuals in the community that are very concerned, for instance, about forcible drugging and forcible shock treatment, which AMI has not gotten into. I've talked to some AMI members also that are opposed to coercive treatments, and I feel that their views often haven't been represented in AMI. But what's happened because of the stigma is that you don't have the consumers themselves coming out and talking. You don't have them coming here and saying, hey, this happened to me. I was in OSH. These drugs hurt me. I want some other alternative. So I'm not trying to disparage anyone personally, but I'm saying that there are a number of voices in the community that do feel strongly about civil rights, that it's not a total consensus to for coercion.
Thank you. Donald Barnes. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Jefferson Hamlin. Excuse me, Hamlin, members of the committee. My name is Don Barnes. I'm a staff attorney with the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office, 630 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Telephone number is 225-9100. I was privileged beginning in July of 1985 to have been a member of both the State Task Force on Civil Commitment of Mentally Ill Persons, in addition to the Multnomah County Task Force on Potentially Dangerous and or Chronically Mentally Ill Persons. I'm of course very grateful for having had the opportunity of associating with the many members of both groups who are so obviously dedicated to the provision of proper mental health care to some of our least fortunate citizens. The method of operation of both task forces was to seek information in the form of testimony from a number of groups: judges, providers of health care, corrections officers, police representatives, members of governmental subunits, and virtually everyone but the mentally ill themselves. The common themes that existed in most of the testimony evolved into the ultimate, very regrettable fact that our methods of providing mental health care, both voluntary and involuntary, simply do not work. In spite of the dedication and concern of the providers of care, the resources we have are so grossly inadequate that we do not deal comprehensively with problems of the mentally ill. Instead, their treatment frequently takes, in an individual case, an incremental or bit-by-bit approach, with interruptions in treatment followed by inadequate aftercare, and both of these things contribute to the cyclic phenomena, which we know as the revolving door syndrome of commitment, release, inadequate follow-up care, decompensation, and recommitment. For example, I've attached to my testimony a copy of the Multnomah County report, and on page 4 you'll see a description there of one person who in a 20-month period in Multnomah County was committed 30 times. As I recall the testimony leading to that conclusion, there was virtually no follow-up care any of the 30 times. That part of the report goes on to state that one-third of the people who were committed in Multnomah County over a considerable period of time were repeats. The conclusions that I reach from the wealth of information provided to both of the task forces I was on are based primarily upon the testimony of the providers of community treatment and care. It seems that the most tragic deficits in the overall system exist at the community treatment level. This part of the system, of course, is responsible for providing follow-up care after release from the hospital, in addition to providing early intervention with those who voluntarily seek treatment. This level is also responsible for continuing maintenance care for those people who are chronically ill and require virtually continual access to mental health services. The testimony of many of the providers is that they simply do not have adequate resources to deal with the majority of their clients. For example, they say they are unable to provide post-hospitalization care, which constitutes the continuum of care which is absolutely necessary to ensure continued improvement and reintegration into society. I would submit that hospitalization not followed up by appropriate care, placement, residential placement, and the other things that are necessary for some of these very fragile people really constitutes a form of abandonment by the mental health system. The providers are likewise unable to accept for outpatient treatment or hospital referral most of the people who seek volunteer treatment. In Multnomah County, and I'd refer you to the exhibit again, Multnomah County has approximately one-half the state's chronically mentally ill. However, only one-half to one-third of the voluntary priority one cases can receive any treatment at all. The balance are refused treatment and sent away. The priority one group is defined as those persons who are at immediate risk of hospitalization or who are in need of continuing service to avoid hospitalization or are dangerous to themselves or others. In other words, people who are virtually committable.
Mr. Chair. Representative Bellamy.
Yes.
Don, I'm very sorry, but you got 8 or 9 pages of testimony here, and I really don't have any idea where your position is on the bill or what you're leading to.
My position.
I would prefer you to summarize. I mean, I'm...
Representative Bellamy, let me follow up. If you could, and I'm looking at this written testimony, if you could give us some idea of where you're going, because I have to agree with Representative Bellamy, and perhaps summarize, because... we can take this home and do our reading if we get a sense of where you're going, and we don't have a page to look at outline-wise to know exactly where it is you are going.
Be glad to do it very briefly. Having been on both of those committees, I think the priorities became disarranged to the point where the emphasis is totally placed upon commitment, and the same time disregarded the most obvious gap in the continuum of treatment system, and that is outpatient care, in two forms. First, the absolutely essential kind that has to exist for people who are released from the hospital in order to prevent their decompensation and going back to the hospital or getting worse and doing something horrible in society. There also has to be some kind of conscionable care for people who go to a mental health center and ask for it. As of now, we see people who are desperately ill who go day after day and are refused. We see people who go to Danish State Hospital who are refused, who can only ironically get into that hospital when they've deteriorated to the point where they don't want to and have to be involuntarily committed. Excuse me, very briefly stated, like the first step in the process for this body or for the Senate or for anyone else who is concerned about this problem is to ensure that absolutely adequate outpatient care facilities exist and then deal with commitment. In other words, deal with the problem in the logical way that it can be solved.
Representative Dix.
So you're suggesting that we not pass this measure in light of, unless through the Ways and Means process there is adequate funding for outpatient.
It has to be there first. To put more people into the system would collapse it. Virtually every single person who testified before both those groups said, if you put more people into the system, you will damage the system, you will diminish its capacity to provide what minimal services they can provide now. It has to be there. Any other questions?
No other questions, and you were much better that way than reading them.
Thank you.
We got the point. Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Barnes, I'm going to ask you pretty much the same question that I asked the gentleman from the ACLU. And directing your attention to page 5, line 10, do you have the bill in front of you, by any chance?
Yes, I do. Page 5, line 10.
Large C again.
I know what it says.
And I'm asking you this question in your capacity as an attorney who works in this area. Do you feel that as the C is currently written, that it would stand constitutional challenge?
No, I don't, and not because of the term episode, but because of the prospective character of it and because of the use of the term likely. Who knows what likely means?
Let me follow up on that. What does the word prospective mean?
This provides for commitment of people who may at some time in the future need hospitalization. It also provides for commitment of people who may in the future not need hospitalization. Absolutely unnecessary commitments.
You lost me. May. Well, first of all, what does the word prospective mean as you used it?
Under current law, people can be committed if they are currently, at the time of the hearing, chronically mentally ill and dangerous or unable to care for their own personal needs. This bill provides for commitment if in the future they are likely to become dangerous or unable to care.
Let me ask the question again. What does the word prospective mean?
In the future.
Thank you.
Do you feel that this section could be redrafted so it could still have an expanded scope and yet withstand constitutional muster?
I think it probably could by using some formula of medical probability. Possibly. It's really hard to say. I haven't done the extensive kind of research I have to do to determine whether or not something would withstand a constitutional challenge. I think now it would not.
Yeah,
I was just going to comment, Mr. Barnes, it's amazing for you to say possibly we could find some words using the word probably.
Well,
Representative Bellamy.
I have a concern about the constitutionality too. I guess there are a lot of really legitimate concerns that have been raised, and there's some very legitimate purposes that have been raised, and I guess My umbrella question to you is, having sat through a couple of days of these hearings, do you think that there still is a function for the original participants who struggled with these issues, I expect, long and hard, who probably foresaw most of the questions that are troubling the committee and the questions that are the basis for the testimony and for the splits in opinion on the bill? And do you think at this point that there is any further purpose for having members of the task force get together now that the hotspots are clear here and come up with something which would effectively move the two sides closer together and bring us some amendments that we could feel comfortable with?
Absolutely, yes.
You do think there is a role then for another meeting of either an ad hoc task force or the original task force?
Yes, and we struggled for more than just a couple of days. An awful lot of work went into this. The final decision to recommend expanded criteria was a 6-5 plurality, and it was made in the context of expanded criteria being substantially down the list of priorities. The other priorities were removed for economic purposes. One would have to wonder whether the same vote